Everyone, this evening to the first talk of a five-talk series. We've had inroads into this topic of distorted mind states in prior talks. In fact, these are new talks, but we will have had 15 different talks on different aspects of how the mind distorts itself around some facet of reality. This series will include the worried mind, which is tonight, and have also within it the doubting mind, the driven mind, the arrogant mind, and the indulgent mind. Something there for everyone. So it's important for us to look at how our minds get warped, and around a particular worry or fear or desire, grasping. And although not directly in the suttas teaching of the Buddha, nevertheless, as each of these mind states begin to be investigated, we'll find the root causes that is very much a part of the whole of the Buddhist tradition. And I know that I can sound a little bit the fear is offering so many talks that have a kind of pain quality to them that one begins to wonder where the lighter side of the equation is. Where is the joy here? Where is the happiness? Where is the bubbling quality, the lightness? And I think that we have to be very clear, although we and I will certainly give talks pointing in that direction, that light side, lighter side, is not necessarily something that we seek apart from these disturbing, more disturbing, distorting qualities. In fact, for us to fully understand the distorting qualities opens itself to the light side of the mind. We get encased in the particular perception in how we see the world. And that encasement, that contraction around a particular way that we distort reality, keeps the light from entering. And so we don't have to seek the light. We just have to free ourselves from the distortion. And that's a very hard, it can be very hard for us to understand. It's not that the worried mind is always worried, that it never feels the sense of joy and contentment. It does. There are times when that very much plays into everyone's life to some degree or other. But if we have conditioned that view and perception into our life, then worry is going to have a lot of interference. It's like the static on a radio, a clear radio station. There's going to have a lot of interference. And unless we understand the nature of that, then we're never going to get to the clear channel of our heart's sure release. So I ask for your patience in exploring these distorting qualities of mind. And had I thought it out a little better, I probably wouldn't have put it on 14, after 14 weeks of fear talks. So the worried mind, the troubled mind, the fretting mind. One anonymous quote I liked said, "Worry is like a rocking chair. It will give you a lot of movement and something to do, but it won't get you anywhere." And often when we give a talk on the hindrances, we talk about the hindrance of restlessness and worry. And although I'm not going to speak a great deal about restlessness, I would like just to introduce, you know, that's sort of the physical component of a worried mind. The sense of being contained somehow, wherein the energetic feeling of the body, like a caged animal, is trying to get out, trying to break out of it. And when that is deeply felt, often there is an accompanying mental state of agitation. In fact, in that sense of mental agitation and physical restlessness, oftentimes there's the grasping of an idea or of an activity without the awareness of the consequences of that activity. So there's not clear comprehension because you just, it's such a troubling and difficult quality to have any steadiness in that you just want out. You just, you know, the flee, the escape clause is so emphatic. And so I was speaking with another Dharma teacher this last weekend. I was over at Spirit Rock, and he was telling me of acquaintance and he told me the following story, that this man, this student of his, had a great deal of restlessness. And would follow him in and out of retreat. And this man was feeling the restlessness one day when he was out of retreat in his home. And he decided that he was going to make a sort of a temporary hot air balloon just for something to do. And his idea was that he would buy 45 helium weather balloons, and then he had it all mathematically worked out so they would float 30 feet above his backyard, and then he had a pellet gun in his pocket, and when he wanted to come down, he would shoot the balloons. Now this is not well thought out. So he got the 45 weather balloons and put him on a chair and started to elevate, but it didn't stop at 30 feet. In fact, he went to 1,100 feet. And he was up there for 14 hours. This is a true story. Until a light plane saw him out over the ocean and radioed in some assistance for him. And a helicopter finally rescued him after 14 hours in the air. And he was charged with violating airspace. Now, I show you that as an extreme grasping at activity in order to have something else to do, something to get away from our often hectic inward pacingness that we call restlessness. Now, a restlessness, when lived with long enough, will evolve not only into an agitated mind, but that agitation will take root into worry, into a kind of a crisis, a continual or ongoing crisis in our life. And I'd just like to bring in a metaphrase here. May all beings have ease of well-being. Ease of well-being. Because most of us don't have perhaps worry or restlessness to the extreme, but we're well on that conditioned, within that conditionality because of the pace that we have in our life. Because of how we hold our work world and our personal life. Without, if there's a dis-ease of the mind in this day and age, it would be the belief that we do not have time. We do not have time. We don't have time to meet the world. We don't have time to even, as the poem I read says, to know that we're lost. And I think at least we can get a sense from a talk like this that where we are on that continuum of worry. Now let's look at the worried mind, if we can. It's where a potential crisis is seen in every perceived challenge in the future. And the worried mind makes it all a problem of me. It's up to me. It's up to me to have to do something about this. So there's a tremendous sense of self-importance and empowerment that worry gives us. In fact, you might say that worry, if it's lived long enough, if we live with it long enough, we almost have a savior complex. It's interesting, those of you who have a tendency towards that, there's a belief in worrying that unless you worry, this is how insane it becomes, it isn't going to turn out right unless you worry. That somehow the universe needs your mental agitation to stay its course. We believe that. And if we back away, if we offer ourselves ease of well-being, it doesn't feel like we're not meeting the crisis with our savior complex. And disaster obviously will be the result. Now, if we live long enough with that idea of our self-empowerment saving the world from crisis, or our family from crisis, or I from crisis, then that's going to become a posture, an attitude. It's going to become, as the Buddha said, from a simple thought comes a deed, and from a deed there is activity, and from activity there is habit, and from habit there is character that is formed. So if you take that right on through your life, the character that develops is the character that you're going to die with. And we don't realize it. We think we have, this is just circumstantial. It's that I have a hard job, and of course I'm going to worry because there's a lot of responsibility on me, and worry is an actual byproduct of being responsible and having some pressure. But then you retire, and you see that the worry doesn't end, that somehow the worry continues, even though the environment has changed. And in fact, it was never the environment that induced the worry. That the worry has its own momentum. And I certainly found that out when I left hospice care. You know, instead of worrying about the multiple problems that would arise in the course of a single day, and then when you're at home, the worry mind continues. It just finds other ways to worry about it, like whether your tires have enough air. And you find areas of dissatisfaction in every environment, and then you worry about fixing those things. And it's just never ending. So I really want to caution us on this particular direction our lives may be taking. It's not going to let loose of you. It has you by the throat now, and it'll have you by the throat until you die unless we do something about it. If I can put it that bluntly. And what we do about it, you can't come to a lecture get an intellectual understanding of it and then expect it to dissipate. You have to enter the subject. You have to come into the experience of it and understand it from the inside out, not from the outside in. You can't reflect upon it. You have to enter the worried state and see what it does to you, to see where it takes you. Then you learn about its patterns, its force, its hold. From a safe spot in which worry is not happening, but you're pondering over it or mulling over it, doesn't give you the ingredients, the tools for correction. We have to do it from, and all of Dharma is like that. All of Dharma is like that. That's why you can't go to a lecture and expect this thing to work. That's why we give homework, and that's why we have a follow-up week of discussion. That's why we do meditation. We sit and experience our life firsthand. That's why we do retreats, residential and non-residential. We do all of these activities to begin to embody ourselves firsthand so that we can have the mechanisms in the experience to get to know and understand this experience sufficiently so that we can then, through that understanding, begin to negate its power. But I know very long-term and committed meditators who, outside of the retreat, continue to foster this kind of meddling spirit with their family, with their friends, with their neighbors, because they can't let go of worry. You know, a lot of busybody. And they think not only that their life depends upon their worry, but those around them depend upon their worry. Their children's lives depend upon it. And you can feel the intrusion. People, unless you have been brought up in a family where you have that common belief system and have come to depend upon your parent to offer worry to the situation. But this is not a small mind state. This was not chosen just drawn out of a hat. It's a very, very persistent and prevalent state of mind in this culture. Now let's look at some of the assumptions that come in worry. And again, these assumptions can only be known, not longhand, taking notes, although you're certainly welcome to do that, but use your notes, if you do take those, that in the state of worry, you see these experiences arising experientially because it does nothing to know about them unless you use the knowing to take you to the experience. So the first assumption of worry is that now is not safe. Now hurts. Because it holds worry. Because it holds chaos. And so, abiding in now is, we hear it, but don't tell me to do it then. In fact, it's only the future that has hope, that holds hope. Why stay here and now and feel the worry when I can work on the future? Because worry stimulates my need to task the future. Right? Right? And the assumption is that what I have now is under attack or will be under attack. That's what worry is. And because we want now consistent and persistent over time, we're not willing to give up the inevitable change. In fact, the fact of change breeds the worry. So we're already heading with a head-on collision into the laws of nature. driven by the fear of chaos. I have to know the outcome. So the other assumption, another assumption is my security is being threatened. Now is not safe and my security is being threatened. And because my security is being threatened, and I don't know what the outcome is, I'm going to work diligently to assure a certain outcome. Fair enough? That's what worry. Do you see that? Just that dynamics. All you have to do is look at it. You get to know it real quick. We say, in effect, chaos will stop here. Change will stop here. A third assumption is that left on its own, the world is chaotic and whimsical, unpredictable, and therefore unsafe. And from that, extrapolating from that, it is not on my side. It's not going to go the way I want it to go. I have proof. I look at my life, I have proof. And therefore, I can't trust it. And therefore, I have to fix it. Because I'm not going to relax with something untrustworthy, and my life proves it's untrustworthy. I didn't get the job I wanted, or the spouse I wanted, or this or that, or... Right? So the fix-it mentality is very much associated with this sense of worry. And one of the reasons it's so entrenched in our culture is because by nature, our culture is a culture of mechanics. We're all mechanics. We have honed our science so that we believe that any problems that arise are just impediments, and that knowing, if we had the right tools and enough understanding, we'll be able to fix these impositions. And that we have such belief in the technology, the sophisticated technology of our mechanics, that we have taken this into the psychological realm as well. I fixed myself psychologically. And I ask you a question, because I like to point out the meditation and how we hold the meditation. Does your meditation hold that fix-it quality? Are you using your meditation to fix your life rather than looking at where it's unfixed, which is what meditation is supposed to do, not provide an alternative life that will be a life that is fixed? And very quickly, very subtly, you can use it that way. Task-centered meditation, where every problem, by its nature, when it arises, we bring forth the tools of our trade to fix it. Even the Dharma tool. Okay, I'll just leave it alone. I'll just allow it. I'll just let it be. I'll say, this will pass, this will pass, this will pass. You see, it's the attitude. The attitude will decide whether the tool works or not, dharmically. But if the attitude is one based in worry, and therefore one in which task and fixing it is predisposed, then the attitude will distort the tool so that the tool will never work except by reinforcing the attitude. You get all that? So we become stronger worriers through our meditation. It's possible. And probable in some cases. You see, anything but entering the experience of it. And again, that's the point. It's the point. I can say that's the point, and I can offer homework, and I can offer classes in which we come together and try to integrate into that point through our discussions, but I can't, that's all I can do. Each one of us have to pick it up for ourselves. See, the difficulty is that worry wants to work out the solution prior to the rising of the problem. Now, we're not going to be very successful in doing that. I was trying to think of an example of this, and I remembered when I was 12 years old and I had my first girlfriend in junior high, I think I was, maybe sixth grade, seventh grade, something like that. And I finally worked up the nerve, probably took me a month to work up the nerve that I would call her. And I was so afraid of that interaction that I wrote down everything that I was going to say and questions I was going to ask. And so it was just, you know, and then so then I had this on the phone. I called up, and then I just like went from one question to next question, next question. There was no connection, obviously. And I got off the phone and I thought, oh God, phew. I remember the sense of relief. Trying to solve the problem through worry, through strategizing, prior to the arising of the challenge. It's only when you can meet the challenge, experience the challenge, that you'll have any creative response to the challenge. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't look, you know, if you have driving a car and you need to change the oil prior to the engine breaking down because you haven't changed the oil. It's not about taking steps for future results. It's about the attitude in which we hold the problem. So understand that. Could somebody close the light? The sun's coming right in. Thank you. And when we hold that kind of anxiety around the attitude of life, then life is really a burden. We can only live it after the burden is over, right? So, you know, after the worry has subsided. But the worry doesn't subside. It subsides for a while. But because our whole sense of self is propagated and perpetuated by the worry, we won't let worry too far away. And so we never quite get to the point where we can live life unburdened. And one of the ways that we keep burdening it is through planning and preparing. Yeah? You planners and preparers? Planning, 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 mind, planning, mind, planning, mind, planning, mind, planning, planning. It's one of the most often heard miseries of meditation retreats. What do I do about my planning mind? That in judging. The need to plan, the need to plan. I used to have a boss who I hope is not listening to this tape. Who would have us in meetings, and we would have to plan out every contingency. And it just isn't my style. In fact, my wife and I will start out on a trip, and I'll just want to get in the car and go. And we'll worry about how to get there as we're getting there. That's not the best way either, believe me. But I prefer, to meet the challenge rather than to plan for the contingencies. And it would drive me crazy sitting in these meetings, you know. More than that, it would deflate my energy. Because you're constantly working towards the resolution of the future. And if there's anything, for God's sake, in Dharma, we begin to understand is that that's an absurd and insane way to relate to life. And that is at the heart of worry. And what's the payoff of worry? I like to go to the payoff, as you realize. If you're going to put all your chips on the Ace of Spades, let's see what the Ace of Spades holds for us. It's self-empowerment. We're gods in waiting. Because we give ourselves unsurpassed power to control events in the future through our agitation now. And so the payoff is the power and the view of the world in which you're a monarch. And it's a self-affirmation. Without me, it wouldn't turn out all right, we say. And it enhances the sense of me and my influence in life. And since many of us feel cut off from having much to say or much empowerment in our direct interactions, worry allows us to be sort of the Walter Mitty of empowerment. I can, through worry, through the future, my empowerment comes through the future, not through the momentary interactions. Most of us don't feel empowered in our life. You know, we look at our political culture and we don't feel connected to that. We look at how the environment and we see what's happening to that. We don't feel empowered to change that. We feel impotent in much of our concerns. And so the only expression we have to gain a foothold into our empowerment is to set it forth in future through worry. God's in waiting. Because we cannot accept the pain of our powerlessness. We have a lack of trust. Because we only know me, we can only believe in me and I. I don't know what else I can believe in. I don't believe the thing is going to move on its own accord in any direction but awful. Now, once you have assumed the truth of a thought that you can't accept something, you will then have the accompanying emotion of that assumption. I can't accept this situation. I can't accept my powerlessness. Once you've assumed that a thought, you've assumed that thought and the assumption associated with it, then you'll have the accompanying emotion, of that assumption, which is worry or anger or violence, or I mean it can be anything, but we're looking at this particular expression, this particular emotional expression. And so we will struggle to overcome our powerlessness, which is the assumption. However, the struggle itself creates more pain. And because our response to pain is to worry, worry generates worry. You see that? Isn't that amazing? Sometimes you look at these things, you go, whoa, the cat's chasing its tail here. If we have a predisposition, when pain arises, to worry about it, to try to fix it, then we are going to increase our worry when pain arises, which is further struggle, which is further pain, which creates further worry. But we don't see it. We don't understand it. We don't see. That's why it's not good enough. And I can't say this enough. And the reason I'm saying it so often is because I'm not interested in lecturing as if I were in school somewhere. I want us all to come in here. I want our lives to be better. I want this to have some effect on us, on our life. And it's not going to until you invite a clear view of the problem from having the problem. This is the art of meditation. Not the art of sitting quietly for 45 minutes, but discerning the assumptions of self and seeing how those assumptions are driven by insanity. Because we've never looked at it. We've never really seen it. And only when we do, we say, this is insane. What am I doing this for? And sometimes we have to go a long time seeing those things before we're even willing to release ourselves then. It's not often the first time. And you missed, in the worry and the empowerment and the movement away from pain, we missed the beauty of the synchronicity of the universe. I mentioned this movie last week, and I want to say it again. It's coming, I heard, the 15th of May to some theater here in Seattle. It's called What the Bleep Do We Know? I really suggest you going to see that. It's a beautiful confluence of mysticism and science. And one of the things is the synchronicity of the world, of the universe, and how the mind constantly juxtaposes upon that synchronicity. And one of the scientists that was in the movie, dialoguing a little bit, he says every morning before he gets up out of bed, he says, let me see the serendipity of life today. Let me see that. Let my heart be open to the wonderment. So I tried that. Saw the movie. Oh, that's a good. Let me try. And lo and behold, sometime during that day, something will happen that absolutely defies logic or reason. You know, you've had those experiences. Well, you turn the corner and there's the very person you were thinking about in a town of 1.5 million people. Or you have this, I was in Thailand, and they have wonderful fruit in Thailand. But I was missing peach. I wanted a peach. You never see a peach in Thailand. There are no peaches in Thailand. And somebody offered me a peach that day. Right when I was having that, you see, the synchronicity, the wonderment, the mystery. You want joy, connect with that. If you want to be assured that life has its own course and that you are insignificant in its determining that course. You're very significant, but not the way you believe yourself to be. Watch it come forth through you. Watch the manifestation of that wonderment play through you. Not from your directedness, certainly not from your worry, not from your influence, but the play of the mystery through you, which is really where your influence lies. And it allows, after a number of occasions upon that, you get really comfortable with that. In fact, it's not even that startling anymore. And things just start popping up. And the more one relaxes into the harmonic relationship, the more that creative influence has field to play. It takes trust, it takes relaxing, it takes ease of well-being. May we all have ease of well-being. So can we hold the worry now? Not let worry try to work itself out in the future, renovate the future. Don't let it take us out of the time frame we're in. Hold the worry where it's expressing itself, which is now. Even though it's an uncomfortable, unpleasant, chaotic sense of now, the mind can learn not to use that chaos to point forward into time. As soon as you do, as soon as you reach out of the now and point forward into time, you break the connection with your heart. If you want heart, you're not going to find it through that. It becomes all of the world becomes the vision, which is most of our worlds, of our own influence. That's an obnoxious world. It's a very sad world. It's a world of your own making. And you, most of us live in a world of our own making. How satisfied are you? Doesn't the other one sound a lot more enticing? How are we going to get there except our willingness to release through the understanding, through the direct experience? This isn't working. Yes, I know all about the worried mind, except how to end it. You see? So we learn to breathe into the obsessive quality of worry. To take concrete steps to offset any, to change our oil. And to look around to see how the display of mind is affecting others. So it's not just about your own troubles, but seeing how the meddling spirit of worry leans into other people's space, into other people's presence. And to relax into this thing. Enjoy the sight of it. It's wonderful to start taking these mind states apart and making them workable. Just take them apart. You know, that's what we're doing. We're just taking this awful mind state that we followed us and our parents had it. Now we're just, okay, let's just throw it out. Like jacks. You're just tossing it out there. Okay, let's see what we can do here. It's beautiful to do that. Because now there's space between the jacks. It's not all clumped in, you know, some cluster. So I see that guy. I see myself doing that too. We don't take ourselves so frenetic and fanatical. We don't take ourselves to be such a serious, oh, I'm so troubled by my worry. Well, what is that? You're worried about your worry? Good. You're on the right course to further worry. To develop that lightness. You see, the lightness comes from throwing the jacks. See where the lightness comes from? not from the clump. So may we all have ease of well-being. Can we sit for a minute or two?